DJ Uiagalelei with the first touchdown pass of his career as he talks things over with Dabo Swinney. How about the other day Dabo said, hey, I went to go tell him Trevor tested positive for COVID. You're going to be the starter. He was in the film room all by himself. That's where you want to see your true freshman quarterback, isn't it?
With the top quarterback in college football still quarantined for COVID, the world is going to get another glimpse of Clemson's rising freshman star. A top recruit from California leads the Tigers in Saturday's climactic matchup against Notre Dame. And we get the backstory on why he's been an enormous prospect since middle school as he steps into the spotlight. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Thursday, November 5th. This is ESPN Daily. David Hale, thank you for joining me today. I have a pressing question for you.
I'm happy to try and answer this for you. I make no promises in advance.
College football reporter David Hale has 10 things you need to know about Clemson's backup quarterback today on ESPN.com. No one should at this point. However, I just want to make sure I'm getting this right here. Can we get this beautiful name just accurately pronounced here? Help me out.
I have practiced this many times. It is Uiagalelei. That's your emphasis. Uiagalelei. So I've screwed this up a few times. I think I've got it now. Uiagalelei.
Yeah, it's that lelei. Uiagalelei. Is that right?
That is right. I think you've got it.
Oh, boy. Okay, great. It's also important to know, though, he also has some other nicknames.
Yeah, so one that I think people are trying a little too hard to coin is the throw-in Samoan. I'm not sure if I'm down with that one.
Yeah, that feels a little template-ish. I mean, a little tired, baby.
Yeah, I agree. I couldn't agree with you more on this. He is a fan of Big Cinco, which is he wears number 5 and he's big. So it adds up together. He used one of his stipend payments from this year to go out and buy himself a chain that says Big Cinco on it. I think he's getting a little ahead on the name, image, likeness stuff. He's been hashtagging his posts with hashtag Big Cinco. So I'm all for it. That's the one I'm going with.
I applaud DJ Uiagalelei's capitalism here, but I also want to explain for people just how big is this Cinco. David, for those who are not familiar with how he looks, how would you describe DJ for America?
Clemson's very talented, very highly recruited defensive end, Xavier Thomas, checks in at about 270 pounds. DJ is about 15 to 20 pounds lighter than that, but you wouldn't know from the two of them standing next to each other. He's a big, big dude. I would argue you're not going to find many quarterbacks that look like him. He has been compared a little bit to Cam Newton, to Jamarcus Russell, Byron Leftwich, some of those just traditionally huge quarterbacks, but I don't even think that that's necessarily a fair comparison. I mean, he's a unique body type at that position, no doubt about it. I've talked to a number of coaches who have said they have never seen a quarterback that has the arm strength that DJ has. His high school coach out at St. John Bosco in Southern California, you know, this is Bosco's had a ton of talented quarterbacks. Josh Rosen most recently is another one in that group that you're talking about. Matt Barkley, you're talking about Carson Palmer, you're talking about Matt Leinart. I mean, a lot of very, very talented college quarterbacks that have come through there. And his high school coach said, look, there's nobody that is like what DJ is like.
What did you see out of DJ on Saturday against Boston College when he stepped in for Trevor Lawrence? Really, I would say the place and the time when we got most familiar with this kid for the first time ever.
Yeah, you know, I think the biggest takeaway was just the level of calm and coolness that he had about him. We're talking about a quarterback making his first career start for the number one ranked team in the country, and through largely no fault of his own, before halftime, they find themselves down 18 points. That is a really tough position for any quarterback to be in, let alone a true freshman making his first career start. And it just didn't bother him. He had a nice drive right before half that closed it a little bit, had a touchdown run at the start of the second half.
Uiagalelei on fourth and one with ETN flanking him. Pulls and has a big jump play and more. Touchdown, Tigers.
And afterwards, when asked about it, hey, what did you think about this huge comeback? And his answer was great.
I mean, I've been down before, like high school, playing big games and stuff like that. I mean, I thought being down 18, that's not really a lot of points. That's like a three-possession game. I mean, I've been down 25 points before, you know, after halftime.
And it turns out in his state championship game a couple of years ago, they were down, I think, 25-3, and he let it come back, and they won that one 38-35, too. So been there, done that for DJ, and that's kind of the approach that he took to it.
So I want to know more about a kid who says that after this incredibly pressurized situation. What do we know about just how he's wired?
So it's funny. I talked to his old offensive coordinator at St. John Bosco, and he said, DJ's kind of an old man, and I think he meant it as a compliment. He doesn't really go out and do much. He likes football. He likes playing video games. He likes being with his family. That's what he does. He sort of talks about himself as being West Coast, which for any of our listeners out there that have grown up on the West Coast, I think they get that. Those people always used to say, like, you can spot an East Coaster a mile away on the West Coast because you guys just are too amped up about things. He's sort of that opposite end of that spectrum. He's come from the West Coast out East. And all of these things that I think the rest of us fans in the Southeast of college football, you know, the stuff that we get all amped up about, he's just like, nah, yeah, that's football. It's what I do. He referred to his job on Saturday against Boston College as, quote, easy.
I also want to understand how DJ got here. You wrote about him for ESPN.com, and he had a lot of options in high school, but Clemson for a long time wasn't one of them. So what's the story of him ending up with Clemson?
He had his first Power 5 offer in the sixth grade. He had a half dozen offers before he ever played a game in high school. Hmm. People knew how talented he was. But Clemson is not one to go way outside their wheelhouse to try and get a guy that they don't think they're going to land. They're not often going out to California to try and nab a quarterback. He just wasn't really on their radar. And the odd thing is that they were on DJ's radar. He grew up being a huge Taj Boyd fan, watching Clemson back in 2012 and 2013, and thought that offense fits what I like doing. He thought, you know, Taj Boyd throwing deep routinely was right in his wheelhouse. So he says to his high school coach, why isn't Clemson recruiting me? I'd really be interested in them. And it just so happened that Brent Venables, Clemson's defensive coordinator, was out in California recruiting a linebacker. And DJ's high school coach said, hey, I got this pretty good quarterback you might want to take a look at. So Brent calls up their Clemson quarterback coach, Brandon Strader, and Strader calls back a few minutes later after looking at the video, and he's like, yeah, we might want to talk to this guy. So, yeah, you know, it was really DJ recruited Clemson more than Clemson recruited DJ, but I think once the relationship was set in place there, it blossomed pretty quickly, and he spent a half hour in an office with Dabo Sweeney, and that sold him. He told his dad right after that, this is where I'm going. I'm going to Clemson. Never thought twice about it.
You mentioned DJ's dad, and that's this other character that the world met in that game last weekend against Boston College. I mean, we know him as Big Dave. What's the story with Big Dave and that family?
I'm going to tell you that Big Dave is the most entertaining parent of a recruit or college football star I have ever come across. Big Dave has his nickname for an obvious reason. He's huge, but the personality is every bit as big. And he is sort of the hype man for DJ. If you watch the game against Boston College, Big Dave wasn't sitting down at any point.
Touchdown, Tigers! And Big Dave is loving it.
He is always talking up DJ. So on Twitter, on Instagram, on YouTube, everything is about how great DJ is. He'll get in arguments with folks who might want to question DJ on social media, which DJ is not a huge fan of. So all of this has led to, since his sophomore year in high school, DJ had blocked his own dad on social media so that he doesn't have to see any of his dad's posts about him.
Blocking your parents on Twitter, I mean, another veteran move from a young man.
Right. Yeah. You don't want to mess with Big Dave. He used to run celebrity security. So he was a bodyguard for Snoop Dogg and Nick Cannon and Chris Brown, and along with a laundry list of incredibly wealthy Californians that we probably never heard of, but could buy and sell us in a heartbeat.
Yes.
That's what he did. He did that for a long time until DJ was about 9 or 10 years old. And he was saying, you know, I came home one day and DJ was asking me, Dad, why are you never around? Why are you gone for months at a time? And it got to him. And so he quit his job doing celebrity security and went and worked as a school resource officer at a public school. And he said, I started making in a month what I used to make in a day. And it was a really hard financial decision for the family, but he did it because he didn't want to miss out on time with his boys. But the funny addendum to all of that is he had a good friend of his who works with Snoop Dogg, called him up after Saturday's game and was like, Big Dave, man, I got to apologize. When you talked about DJ all the time when he was a kid, we thought you were crazy. Turns out you were 100% right. This kid's awesome.
All right, David, coming up, I want to take a closer look at this enormous matchup on the field between Clemson and the Fighting Irish.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with the smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo, another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
So, David, I want to zoom out a little bit before we dive in again. So Clemson and Notre Dame are facing off on Saturday, but simultaneously, the Pac-12 is finally beginning their season. They're playing this in-conference, truncated, seven-game schedule. And our own Paul Feinbaum says that that shortened schedule could play a big part in creating the scenario where both Clemson and Notre Dame get into the college football playoff. So how do you see the Pac-12, David, being involved in these end-of-season rankings?
Look, the playoff committee has a difficult job every year, but this is way beyond the scope of what they certainly imagined their jobs were going to be when they all signed up for this. How do you compare potentially, say, 7-0 Oregon with a Notre Dame team that, let's say Notre Dame wins this week without Trevor Lawrence playing and loses in an ACC championship game to Trevor Lawrence. Notre Dame now is 11-1. How do you balance those two things? And I don't know that there's an answer to it, but as Paul rightly suggests, winning four more games than the undefeated team in that other league that didn't start playing until November has to mean something. The job for the playoff committee is next to impossible this year. I think their biggest hope has to be that the teams on the field make it pretty clear who the top four are. I'm guessing that they were probably kind of crying some tears over Trevor Lawrence being out, because that only adds this extra degree of difficulty, this extra little asterisk next to results that, oh, by the way, the best player in college football didn't play in the biggest game of the year for Clemson.
Yeah, yeah. I want to get into this matchup on the field now, because Clemson and Notre Dame is a huge matchup in the strangest year we've ever seen. And there is some added weight to that matchup this season because of where they both sit in the ACC conference. What's that dynamic like, David?
It's interesting, certainly, because the dynamic has never existed for Notre Dame before. I mean, this is a program that has vehemently argued that they never want to be a part of a conference, that were forced into a conference and are now saying, like, look at us running the show in this conference. They're like guy who said he was too good to come to your party and then comes over and he acts like he owns the house. I would venture to guess that the majority of ACC fans that are not Clemson fans are still rooting for Clemson for exactly that reason. But Notre Dame's also in a little bit of a no-win situation this week, because if they win this game and they do it in any way that is other than sort of just running all over a Clemson defense, the narrative is going to be, yeah, but no Trevor Lawrence. So what happens then? And I think it all then boils down to, do they see each other again in Charlotte for an ACC championship game? And what happens then? Whereas Clemson's in a little bit of a no-lose situation, because as long as they win out the rest of their games, pretty much anything can happen in this game, and they'll get another crack to reframe the narrative in December in an ACC championship game.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing that, like, Clemson is as big a power in college football as we have right now. But really, only Notre Dame and their reputation, their swaggering, we own this place reputation, can turn them into something of this, like, brand underdog that you're like, you know, I want to make sure that this big bully gets its comeuppance.
Right, right. Well, I thought DJ, by the way, had it was sort of like this subtle dig at Notre Dame that I'm sure he was not meaning. People were asking about whether Notre Dame had recruited him, and he said, oh, not really, you know. But it's pretty cool they had that movie Rudy made about them. And I was like, there's a lot more to Notre Dame's history than that, but it's cool that you're boiling it down to just Rudy.
Oh, that's great. I also want to ask you the question that I think Notre Dame for a while has been asking itself heading into this game in particular, which is, wait a minute, are we sure there is no Trevor Lawrence? What is the latest with him?
Right. If I were him, I would be fully dressed out for this game just to put a little scare into Notre Dame. But no, he will not play. He will travel with the team. So the ACC's guidelines for a return to play are pretty explicit in that you have to spend 10 days in isolation after showing symptoms or testing positive. That 10 days will be up Thursday or Friday for Trevor, so he will not be considered contagious and can be around other people, other players, coaches, staff at that point. But there's the flip side to that, which is, how healthy is Trevor?
Right.
And for that, the guidelines are a little murkier. Number one, the ACC requires a battery of cardio tests that he will have to pass first, and that doesn't happen overnight. In fact, one of them is a blood test that looks for this protein that the heart produces if there is damage to the heart. And that takes probably 24 to 48 hours to get results for. So all of that adds up to a timeline in which he is not going to be available to play. But beyond that, Clemson says there's a reacclimatization period, that you're not going to just take this guy who has done nothing except sit on his couch for 10 days and throw him right back onto a field. As Dabo Swinney said the other day, look, if he was doing my job, it'd be no problem. But because he's being chased down by 300-pound defensive ends, the hurdles to get him back are a little higher. And so, you know, I would expect he will be back on the practice field early next week, but definitely will not be playing against Notre Dame.
Yeah, and especially that defense in particular, which you called rightly, David, earlier, the best in the country, baby. So what else stands out to you about this Notre Dame team?
You know, the defense is the thing I think that is certainly going to get all the talk, but I have some questions about the offense. And Ian Book, great veteran quarterback. I think guy knows the system. He's confident in what he does. He can run a little bit. Very good offensive line. They've had a lot of success running the football. They've got some good running backs. They're deep there. But they don't really force the issue on the outside at receiver. They don't stretch the field super well. They have not had much of a downfield passing game at all, despite playing a pretty lackluster schedule so far. And I add all that up on the offensive side, and I say they look a lot like Miami. They've got that veteran quarterback who can move. They want to run the football, but they just don't have guys who match up on the outside. And we saw what Miami did against Clemson's defense, virtually nothing. So to me, this is the big red flag if you're Notre Dame, is there a plan B offensively? Because what Brent Venables loves to do is take away whatever it is that you most want to do, whatever it is you're most successful at. And Notre Dame has gotten by on doing plan A over and over and over again and doing it with some success. If that can't happen against Clemson, what's plan B?
Yeah, and the context here for Clemson and Notre Dame, I mean, these schools have played four times over the years. The last time was in 2018. Clemson destroyed the Irish 30-3. So in terms of the case for Notre Dame against Clemson, what's that case look like?
You know, I think there's a couple of things that Notre Dame has going for it. Again, number one, they've got an exceptional defense that I think can challenge Clemson in a way that couldn't when they last played in the playoff a couple of years ago. I think you're going to see a little bit more of the tight ends being used. This is a thing that Notre Dame, I feel like they've been talking about how good their tight ends are all season without actually doing much with their tight ends. But it's a good opportunity to do it, because where Clemson is going to be a little bit deficient this week is at linebacker. Their starting middle linebacker, James Skalski, will not be playing in this game because of an injury. We're still not quite sure how healthy Mike Jones Jr., their best outside linebacker, is going to be, because he didn't play last week. He's getting over some injuries. And at safety, you know, Nolan Turner is a really, really good safety, and he's probably better against the pass, but he's undersized, especially if he's being matched up against a tight end or a good running back out of the backfield. And I think that that presents some potential mismatches for Notre Dame that they can identify. Now, can they execute on those mismatches? I think that's still a big question, but I think there is some opportunity for it to happen.
Yeah, and the other huge name on this Clemson offense is Travis Etienne. He's going to be very much in this lineup. He might be the best running back, if not the best skill position player in college football. How does that Notre Dame defense aspire to stop Etienne on Saturday?
Right. So I think this is the big goal for Notre Dame. And again, Boston College tried to do it on Saturday. Now, they are not nearly as well equipped to do so as Notre Dame is, but they were stacking the box. They didn't want Etienne to run against them. But the problem is that Etienne has developed so much as a receiver. They'll flank him out outside. You saw, I think, one of the little out throws from DJ to Travis, and he goes for a touchdown.
He's a true freshman quarterback now sensing pressure off the edge. They come after him, and smartly gets it to Etienne, and off to the end zone goes Travis Etienne.
Those types of things that he can do makes him such a weapon outside of whatever it is that you're trying to prevent him from doing. You know, if you're trying to take away the running game, he has other things that he does well. You know, one of the big, I think, takeaways was that Etienne finished with another really good game. And he's played six quarters without Trevor Lawrence over the last few years, and he's got five touchdowns in those six quarters. So it goes to show you that even when the other team knows, like, this is the guy we've got to stop, he's the best player on the field, they've still not had a whole lot of success doing it.
So it sounds like you're giving Notre Dame a puncher's chance, an underdog's chance against Clemson on Saturday. Is that your feeling about this?
You know, to me, I keep coming back to the receiver positions on both sides. I think both teams desperately need someone who is going to stretch the field a little bit, because if these two teams are playing in sort of a phone booth, it's going to become an ugly game. And I think then Notre Dame's chances go up a good bit. But one of the things, another thing from Boston College game that was not really talked about enough is Cornell Powell had a really good game. And afterwards, was talking about how much Dabo was riding him that whole week. You got to step up. You're a senior. You're a receiver. We need you to step up. And I'm certain that that was about beating Boston College, but I'm even more certain that was about getting him ready for Notre Dame. If they give this freshman quarterback with a big arm a chance to show off that big arm downfield, I think Clemson is going to win probably fairly easily.
And I would imagine that at the very least, DJ is mindful of a sort of underdog story coming out of Notre Dame, because he at least has seen the movie Rudy.
It would not be as good a story. Rudy is a great movie. It wouldn't be as good with DJ, but I feel like there's a whole other movie to be written about DJ that would be much more entertaining too.
Yeah, I would watch that movie. David Hale, I appreciate you explaining who exactly DJ Uiagalelei actually is.
You got it.
Up next. Do you want to know what would happen if, like, John Gruden ended up coaching Manchester United? Our next very special guest might have some input.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
Here's another story. I want you to know. I was deeply huffing election coverage after midnight yesterday when I felt the onset of something close to a panic attack. At which point I found myself then turning off my cable box and escaping into the show that has become my personal psychological safe space. Ted Lasso. Ted Lasso, the Apple TV Plus comedy, is about an American football coach who gets hired to manage the fictional AFC Richmond, a soccer team in the English Premier League. But the biggest reason the show has become this cult classic is simple. It makes people feel good. So I asked Ted Lasso himself, the actor and creator of the show, Jason Sudeikis, to join me inside the panic room that is ESPN Daily. Jason, I was going to say, you're in the middle of writing season two right now of the show.
Yes.
That has become the palate cleanser I've been turning to as I otherwise am like huffing the glue of cable news. Like, it's become this ideal escape for me this week in specific. And I just wonder, like, people who come to you and say, thank you for giving me something that is so different from the world around us right now. How often is that the feedback that you get about this show?
You know, I mean, it is interesting because it's like, you know, because we had the idea and I don't mean just like the idea of like, oh, like this should be a TV. This maybe could be a TV show. But like the idea of like what the show was about in 2015, the idea predated, you know, everything that happened in Ferguson, you know, the Me Too and Time's Up movement, you know, Trump, even I think it predated Trump coming down the escalator, you know, so maybe the vibe of the show or what we're trying to accomplish with the show is something that any of us could have used anytime, you know, throughout history. but yeah, I mean, it's a lot of friends like that have watched the first, whatever, there's 10 episodes, the first season, the first five, and then have started again with either their, you know, partner, you know, or their family. I like the idea of, you know, fathers and sons and moms and daughters, you know, watching a show about a goofy coach with a mustache with, you know, with the F-bomb every 10th word.
Well, I wanted to catch people up who haven't seen the show. So Ted Lasso is this American football coach who gets transported to basically tank an EPL team. And how would you describe his philosophy for people who are unfamiliar? Who are like the influences coaching-wise that sort of inspired this particular character?
Oh, definitely John Wooden. That's a big one. John Wooden and his, I mean, straight up philosophy, religion, whatever you want to call it, but his pyramid of success. I mean, they did a great job lampooning it on Parks and Rec and everything. But that was a thing that came into my life about a year and a half, probably post my basketball career. But then when I started coaching and teaching improv in Chicago, I used to teach the pyramid of success because I found it to be so wonderful and on point for like ensemble art, you know, creating something together and just the cornerstones being enthusiasm and industriousness. I'm like, yeah, if you work hard and you give a damn, like, yeah, that's tough to beat. But then I also had, you know, it's not just coaches. It was also just mentors, you know, people that saw something in me. So, you know, people like Tina Fey, you know, who, when I got hired as a writer at SNL and I was like feeling the imposter syndrome big time, she was like, hey, you know, and at that point she was just a hero of mine from, you know, she had just, you know, been on the Second City stages, you know, 3 years prior when I moved in. So she went from hero to mentor to friend. And in that hero to mentor part, she was like, if you can improvise, you can write, you know, cause I didn't think I'd be able to, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. And then, you know, Lauren, a very similar way, you know, but yeah, it's based on those. And then I know a lot of it is based on my dad too. My dad's one of those people that meets you where you're at, you know, he's loquacious like Ted, but he's also going to talk a lot of shit about people.
I was going to ask you also, I mean, the idea of being what seems like a relative jock in comedy/comedy writing. Is that a thing that you sort of saw yourself as entering this business as a former athlete? Was that something that you sort of navigated, that part of your identity?
Not really. Cause I had my time with it. It was like, I got redshirted at a community college, you know, Fort Scott Community College, the Greyhounds. So then it was right into, by that point, I'd already sort of, you know, messing around with like improv. There was a great a theater in Kansas City that I used to go to all the time, like called Comedy Sports, which was basically like almost like Whose Line Is It Anyway? And it was two teams and a referee was the host and they were competing, you know. So my bridge from sports to comedy was Comedy Sports. And I think the only thing that it brought with me was a sense of just group dynamics and working with a team. And just that mentality is just baked into my DNA at that point. And improv and sketch, part of the reason they're my two favorite mediums of comedy is because they are ensemble based and just the potential of the next moment. It was that, but it was also being ingrained with just hard work. Like I was lazy as an athlete, but as like an actor, as an artist, I think I skew hardworking because my baseline is still, you know, some grown man, you know, yelling at me, saying hustle.
As you immerse yourself, Jason, in the writer's room for season two and then season three, because you've been renewed for two seasons already. I mean, is the grind of working on this show something where you can also appreciate the palate cleansing effects that the viewers of it feel?
You know, I can't tell from the inside of it. I mean, you know, it's kind of funny doing these interviews because, you know, I'm still in the forest, you know, here. You know, other people have a view of it that is lovely. And I thought someone would like it. I didn't think as many people would like it or the majority of people that watch it end up digging it. Like, you know, that's just nothing you anticipate. But as far as the execution of doing it and the work doing it, there's no approach to this that is any different than anything I think I've done since I started doing this, since I was like, you know, 17. And it doesn't matter if it's comedy or drama. You just, there's no defense in the arts. The only defense is like our own cynicism and our own apathy. So to quote John Wooden, you know, only concern yourself over which of the things you have control. I do that. And I've done that since the first time I heard that quote, which was from my high school basketball coach, Donnie Campbell. And I thought he made it up, you know. And then I find this little blue book at, you know, Barnes & Noble in Chicago. And I'm like, that son of a took it from this cat. No. Remember growing up and there'd be like a very special episode of you know, Saved by the Bell or Family Ties or, you know, Growing Pains. And it was always around drinking or doing drugs and stuff. You know, I think we won't have necessarily episodes like that where it's like, oh, this is the dramatic episode. I mean, part of the fun for us in creating it and trying to execute it is being able to do both things, make you laugh and make you feel something within the same sentence if we can, you know what I mean? And so I think you'll see things in the second, and well, definitely in the second, because I have a very clear picture of what that is. And then in the third season with some of the bigger ideas for what the arc of this story was always hoping it would have the chance to be.
Well, Jason, at some point, hopefully not too far away, I hope to actually get another meal with you in person.
Me
but
too.
Until then, I thank you for a very special episode of ESPN Daily.
Thank you. I think they're all special. I think they're all special.
That's the motivational speech I needed going into the rest of my evening. I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.